Brother John Martin, speaking to the subject, Moses, the man of faith, and the reading, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 23 to 29.
John?
Thank you, Gordon. Well, brothers and sisters, our chapter in Hebrews tonight takes a little different turn. We've been dealing with the family of faith, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And of course, all the Jews knew, as we do, that that particular family was noted for the attribute of faith. Abraham, for example, earning the title of the father of the faithful, and so on. But tonight we move on to Moses, and I suppose there wouldn't have been a Jew alive who never associated Moses with anything else but law. And it would have been a rather a surprise to them, of course, to see Moses in this light. Not that they would not have conceived him as a man of faith, brothers and sisters, but more they would associate him with law. But here is the lawgiver himself, and here we're going to see in his life the attributes of faith. Now, the first thing that's noted about Moses is the action of his parents. And I believe, brothers and sisters, that this is one of the gems of Hebrews 11, this 23rd verse, which speaks of the action of Moses' parents. And do you know, were it not for the comment of the Apostle Paul upon the incident of them hiding that child for 3 months and then setting him adrift in the Nile, I doubt whether any of us would ever read into that record what Paul read into it. I doubt, brethren and sisters, if we'd ever read into that record what Paul read into it. I think that if we'd have read that story, as we do to our Sunday school scholars, what we would have seen was this, that a boy was born, and he was a lovely little baby, as Exodus describes him, as a good child. And that the hearts of the parents were so touched with the birth of this little fella that they hid him from the king. And for the fear of the king, they hid him. And then later on, when they realized that, this is I'm saying how we would read the story, when they realized they could get caught, they put him on the river and hoped for the best. There's nothing of the sort like that happened, brethren and sisters. Paul makes the point quite opposite to that. He makes this point that the child was hid despite the king's commandment, not out of fear of it. They did not fear the king's commandment. There was something more motivating those men, that man and woman, brothers and sisters, than just a mere love of a child. Now let's get that clearly fixed in our mind. Paul describes it as an act of faith. Now if my child, Sammy Martin, was threatened by a potentate to be destroyed, I would hide him. Because I love him. He's a glorious little fella. But it wouldn't be faith, brothers and sisters. It was because my emotion would be so touched that I would hide that little chap under my bed and hope that he wouldn't be found. That's got nothing to do with faith. But that's not what Moses' parents did. Paul being witness. Paul's point is this. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents. By faith, he was hid 3 months of his parents. Because they saw he was a proper child. Now, if you went back to Exodus, which we won't go back to now, in chapter 2 and in verse 2, he's described as a good child. They saw that he was a good child. The Hebrew word tobe means just that. It means good. So we don't really know from Exodus 2 what they really thought of that child. Because the word good as used there is used in a wide variety of senses, mainly just to be good. But this word is different, brethren and sisters. This Greek word means fair or handsome, and it comes from a root word meaning of a city. They therefore saw that child as having a striking look about him, which indicated to them a great destiny lay ahead of him. I believe that's the choice that Paul makes of that word. Now, if you look in Acts chapter 7 and verse 20, you'll notice that Stephen makes the same point. There was something striking about that child. Stephen uses the same word, brethren and sisters, and it's the only other place in the Greek New Testament where it is found. The only other use of this word is in exactly the same context. And Stephen uses it in Acts chapter 7 and in verse 20. And he says, in which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair. That's the same term as the proper child. And nourished up in his father's house 3 months. Now in the margin, the alternate rendering is given, though it is not a translation of the Greek word, but the alternate rendering is given as being fair to God. And I believe, brethren and sisters, that that is the sense of that word, because both Stephen and Paul make the point that the child was hidden because of the striking look about him, which gave an indication to his parents that that child was a child of destiny. Therefore, when they took him and hid him, it wasn't therefore based upon an emotion towards the child or of the fear of the king. It was the exact opposite. They didn't fear the king's commandment. They risked their life in hiding the child because the commandment was that the child should be killed, and they hid that child because of that reason. He was fear of God. Now you think about that. The Revised Standard Version renders that Acts chapter 7 and verse 20 as beautiful before God. And it seems to me, brethren and sisters, that there was something about that child and some perhaps revelation they were given in conjunction with the look of that child which stamped him out as a child of destiny. And the Jochebed and Amram, his mother and father, recognizing that, hid that child by faith. Now, I'll show you something very interesting. In Acts 7, the next verse says this. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. Acts 7, verse 21. Now, brethren and sisters, you think about this. If they hid that child for 3 months by faith, on what basis did they cast him out? Was it that after 3 months their faith waned and they thought they couldn't take the risk any longer? No, I don't believe it was. I believe that their faith never waned. For this reason, that word cast out is found 3 other times in the New Testament. Now this is important, very important. And in every case it is rendered by the word expounded. Expounding the word. Paul dwelt 2 whole years in his own high house, expounding the things concerning the kingdom of God and so on. And that word is translated 3 times, expounded. It's in Acts 11 verse 4, Acts 18 verse 26, and 28 verse 23. That's the only other time you'll find that Greek word. And the word means to set forth on a mission. So they expounded the word, because the word of God sets God's purpose out and the mission he has with his son and with his purpose with the earth. So that's the sense in which that word is used. In Acts chapter 11 and verse 4, it's used as the apostles came back and expounded what God had done with them during their journeys. They showed the purpose that God had in their lives. So that when Stephen says that Moses was cast out, it's a very poor translation of the Greek. And Rotherham and the Revised Standard Version both use the term, he was exposed. So they didn't put him on the river to continue hiding him. They put him on the river to expose him, to show the boy, to expound him, as it were, to set him forth on a mission. Now that's faith, brothers and sisters. Faith took the child, faith hid him. Faith saw he was a child of destiny. After 3 months, they realized that that destiny had to be put into operation. They chose their moment carefully. They took the boy and put him out on the river to be seen. That's the point Stephen is making. They put him deliberately out there to be seen. Now, when you read the record of Exodus, what do you find? You find the child is put in the river near to where Pharaoh's daughter is going to bathe. And lo and behold, Miriam, his eldest sister, is with the princess of Egypt, and they find the child together, and the appeal of the girl is immediately there. This was a well-conceived plan, brethren and sisters, based upon faith and backed up by the mighty power and providence of Yahweh. Whatever they did was based upon faith. And yet, if you read that story in Exodus, you'd never read it at what Paul saw in it. You'd see in it, as I say, just the actions of parenthood in the protection of its young. But it's more in it than just that. And Paul makes that point. They were not afraid of the king's commandment. They set that child forth on a mission. He was picked up in the right place, and we know the rest of the history, brethren and sisters, that he delivered Israel out of Egypt. Now, do you know something? I don't believe that the actions of those two people, Jochebed and Amram, would ever be forgotten by Yahweh. And you find that throughout the subsequent history of the deliverance of Israel, the names of those two people are used. And they are impregnated in the history of that time, brethren and sisters, because it was by their faith that the great lawgiver had come into the world, and it was by their faith that he was put in front of that princess, and it was by their faith that he came to the position that he did. They were wonderful people. Now, Jochebed means Yahweh will be honored. And Amram means the exalted people. Now, you look at these references. Genesis 14 and 15, or rather Exodus 14 and 15. Here's a testimony to their faith, brothers and sisters. Exodus 14 and in verse 4. Yahweh speaks to Moses, and he says in verse 4, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that he will follow after them. And I will be honored upon Pharaoh." Jochebed, Yahweh will be honored. Verse 17, "And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, and I will get me honor upon Pharaoh." Verse 18, "And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh." Jochebed, Yahweh will be honored. Now, in the next chapter, when the children of Israel sing the song of triumph on the other side of the river, other side of the sea, we read these words in the first two verses of Exodus 15. "Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto Yahweh, and spake, saying, I will sing unto Yahweh, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation, my father's isle, and I will exalt him." Is his father's name. So what did Moses see in the deliverance? He saw an exhibition of his father's power. Not his father's power in that sense, but the father's power in the heavens. His father's strength in the heavens. My father's isle, and I will exalt him. The exalted people. So you see that impregnated into the history of those times was the character of those two lovely people who defied the king's commandment to hide that child, and he deliberately exposed him, seemingly almost to certain death. Could you imagine, brethren and sisters, if that child had have come to the banks of the river, which, humanly speaking, thinking of it humanly, if you were in that situation, 3-month-old child, you know what they're like, having a child for 3 months in your home, that's an enormous impact upon you. You imagine seeing that child go forth, and humanly speaking, he could have come to shore anywhere along that river and come right close to any of the Egyptians, callous in heart, and all they had to do was just tip the little crib up. And then he was in the river, he was. End of him. But faith exposed him on that mighty river. And through that act of faith, brothers and sisters, wonder of wonders, the child came to rest right at the feet of that princess, and through the vicissitudes of life, he became the prime minister in Egypt. What an incredible thing that is. Yahweh will be honored. He will exalt God's people. And that was the name of his mother and his father. And truly, their names did play a big part, didn't they, in the subsequent deliverance out of Egypt. Now, Paul's next point about Moses, as far as faith is concerned, brethren and sisters, has a very striking exhortation in it, particularly to the Hebrews. And, you know, here again, he combines with Stephen to make a point about Moses. They both make the same point again. He says in verse 24, "By faith Moses, when he was come to years." When he was come to years. In Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11, it says, "When Moses had grown." The Septuagint version is one that Paul quotes from. He'd come to years. The Greek word means to become an adult. Now, you might say, oh, he's just making a historical note. Is he? You look at Acts chapter 7 again, and note what Stephen says. He makes it precisely the same point, but Stephen makes it even more pointed. In the 7th chapter of Acts and in verse 23, Stephen makes this point. "And when he was full 40 years old." Paul's point is, when he was come to years. Stephen's point, when he was full 40 years old. Now, brethren and sisters, it just so happened that at the time of the writing to these Hebrews, they were full 40 years old in the truth. And the time had come, the apostle says, that they should have grown to maturity. Chapter 5 and verse 12, brethren and sisters, this was the point he was making. In Hebrews chapter 5 and at verse 12. For when for the time ye ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. For everyone that useth milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Now the point the apostle's making in making that cryptic comment about Moses, that when he was come to years, Stephen's point, full 40 years of age, in other words, brethren and sisters, Moses grew up, and the point that Paul's going to make is this, that at that time he made a decision. He's about to tell them that at that age he made a decision, and they were faced with the day of decision. Exhort one another daily, he says, and so much more as ye see that day approaching. And they were fast approaching, brethren and sisters, an era in history when they had to make a decision. Now, were they going to be the same age of Moses spiritually? That's the point. And he's going to set that before them. Full 40 years of age, as Stephen gives it. And the decision that he made was that he was refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, you can take out of verse 24, brethren and sisters, the definite article. It's not in the Greek. And it makes the point even more pointed, doesn't it? You see, it wasn't the question that Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. What Moses refused, brethren and sisters, was gold letters over the door which says, son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused a title. You can refuse to be called the son of this family or the son of that family. That's one thing. But it wasn't an ordinary family. What he refused was son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused a title. And that's the decision that he was going to make, brethren and sisters, at full 40 years of age. And what would they have to do? They were being asked to make a decision. Right there and then concerning their sonship, were they the sons and daughters of the living God, or would they go back to mum and dad and live under the shadow of the synagogue system, or back to their relation and become the sons of the Judaizers in Israel who would forsake Christ or not accept Christ and find their happiness in the synagogue? Would they do that? Or would they refuse that title, fleshly in all its trappings, and to be known as the sons and daughters of God? Well, that's what Moses did when he became full 40 years of age, and that was about their age in the truth. And what was his choice? What was his choice? Well, says Paul, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. The word choosing is in the aorist tense in the Greek, brethren and sisters. In other words, it really means having chosen once and for all. The point Paul's making is this, that when Moses made a choice, brethren and sisters, it was a clear-cut, once-and-for-all choice. He didn't go out and say, I wonder whether I should be allied with the Hebrews, or whether it's, you know, whether I shouldn't. Should I be an Egyptian? No. Paul's point is this. Moses made a clear-cut decision. I'm those people. They're my people. He chose rather to suffer the afflictions with the people of God. Now, you know, it's very, very difficult for us to appreciate the scriptures, as I've tried to point out time and again, unless you think about it. We were talking about this last night around the readings, and with a couple of brethren and sisters from interstate we had with us, and about study, brethren and sisters. You know, the thing about today, and I believe this is one of the great reasons why we are not, and we are not, let's face it, we are not producing as many Bible students per head of population as we used to. And it isn't because our methods are no better. Our methods are infinitely better because we've learned a lot about methods. It isn't because our standard works are not still available, because they are available and there are extras available with them. And it isn't because we haven't got fellows with experience in the Word, because there are others who have grown up over this period of time who are experienced in the Word. What is the problem?
And I think it's clear cut what the problem is. We have ceased to think. And you can have all the works of the pioneers in your library, brothers and sisters. You can have a most marvelous wide margin Bible and all the modern equipment, rapidograph pens and the like. But I'll tell you what, you'll do more with a burnt end of a stick in your Bible by thinking about the scriptures than you ever will by all your modern equipment. We have forgotten how to think. That's what we've done. Now you think about the situation with Moses. You know, I would dwell for hours upon that verse just thinking about it. And I would come away from the Bible and I would think about that. And I would see him there, full 40 years of age, and I'd try and picture him. I'd picture him in the halls and the courts of Pharaoh's court, sweeping along there in his grandeur, one of the great leaders of Egypt, with all his retinue behind him. I would see Pharaoh's daughter, the princess of the realm, standing up in his presence and honouring him and addressing him to everyone as her son. And Moses in that situation, brethren and sisters, which the flesh laughs with all the adulation of the people around him, could have easily, ever so easily, have bowed to that. And looking into that princess's eyes, could have owned her as a mother, for after all said and done, she'd been very kind to him. He had no reason, any other reason, but to love and respect her for what she had done for him in his life. And yet what did he do? Outside of their great halls, brethren and sisters, down the road quite a bit, down on the banks of the Nile, there were a people with whom it was an abomination for the Egyptians to eat. They wouldn't even eat with them. Who laboured under the lash of the taskmaster, which not only hurt them, brethren and sisters, but degraded them. Degraded them to the level of dogs, slaves, who sat by the flesh pots as he sat by the great in the sumptuous halls of Pharaoh's court. And he made one decision, he never made two, and he made it as clear cut like that. They are my people and you are not. That's Paul's point, and he did that at 40 years of age. Now they'd grown up like that, brothers and sisters, and they were going to be asked very shortly whether they belonged to that synagogue or that ecclesia. As clear as that. And Paul's point about Moses is very pointed as far as the Hebrews are concerned. And he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. The people of God. You know, throughout this book of Hebrews, you find in several places the expression, the people, the people, the people. We don't have to ask what people, we know what people. The people of God. And that's who they were. But who'd ever think that? Who'd ever believe they were the people of God? Moses did. And he accepted it, brothers and sisters. Paul says, by one decisive act, he made a choice there and then, they're my people. And never for a moment did he ever give in to the temptation of son of Pharaoh's daughter. You think about that, because it's a wonderful thing that he did. And why did he choose to be named with the people of God? Because he didn't want to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. The Greek word means for the occasion only. For the occasion only. He had an occasion. He was in Pharaoh's court. He could have enjoyed himself. But that was it, brethren and sisters. There were monuments all around the place. There were the pyramids, of course. There were these things which were built there as a mausoleum for the dead pharaohs of Egypt. They honoured their dead. That's what Egypt worshipped, was death. And everywhere Moses went, he saw their worship finalised in death. The Egyptians absolutely glorified death, though they didn't see it as death. They used to put these mummies in the tomb, wind them up with their spices, a lost art today, preserving the texture of their skin even, for centuries. What for? Because they believed that those people actually went on living. And the preservation of their body to the Egyptians was but emblematic of the fact that they'd gone to another place, all their servants were slain with them. When they buried the king, they buried everyone with him, that he might take his servants and all his possessions, his gold and his silver, his beasts of burden, all of them buried with him, because he just moved from one place to another. And Moses was to enjoy the glory of Egypt, but he knew where they were dead. And he didn't want to enjoy the pleasures of sin, brethren and sisters, for the moment. Moses saw that pleasure terminated right there and then, and he didn't want to be in that. You know, the Greek word is rendered in the 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 18, where it says, we look not upon things which are
temporal, as the apostle says, the temporal things. He says we look upon things which are eternal, and the very word temporal there is the same Greek word, things for the moment only, but then it's gone. And what did he do? He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. Treasures in Egypt. They were proverbial, brethren and sisters. Who would know a reference which indicates the fact that riches were proverbial in Egypt? What reference would you think about? It's not unknown to you. Treasures in Egypt. All this younger set along here with active young memories ought to leap straight to that reference. Treasures in Egypt. Huh? Daniel 11. Doesn't that say that? Look at that.
Treasures in Babylon.
In the 11th chapter of Daniel, verses 42 and 43, speaking about the latter day invasion of the king of the north, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. You see, brethren and sisters, they were proverbial. There may have been other nations which had treasures, but the treasures in Egypt, according to Daniel 11, were proverbial. And Moses stood to be heir of the lot. Now that's where he was standing in life. He was standing on a gold mine, proverbial in the world. But he didn't want that. Treasures in Egypt? No. He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. And you know, brethren and sisters, here's an interesting thing. In that word in verse 26 of Hebrews 11, esteeming the reproach of Christ, the word esteeming really literally means to lead or to put first, and is used in the sense of leading out the mind, setting the mind first of all in one direction. Now, who can think of a very potent quotation to which exemplifies the exhortation, as far as we're concerned, to put first? Of course it is. Matthew 6. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Now, Moses did that. The word esteeming means to set the mind first of all in that direction. So he didn't take any cognizance of the treasures in Egypt. He had a single mind. He put first, brethren and sisters. And what did he put first? The reproach of Christ. What do you think the Apostle Paul is doing by using the term or the title of Christ there? You know, that's not just dropped in there haphazardly. What would be your opinion? Why would he? Yes, Maynard.
Because he was taken from officially
of yes, but you see, he's not talking about the anointing in the sense of glory. He esteemed the reproach of Christ. But see, why does Paul use, first of all, ask yourself the question, why does he use the title Christ? What, in what sense does the apostle use that title? He doesn't use it. Messiah. What he's trying to tell us, brethren and sisters, just by the use of that title, he says, this is what you've got to do when you read the apostle. He drops these things in. For example, he's used it before, but Christ being come, he says in another place, by a greater and more perfect tabernacle. The use of the title Christ there is to show that Messiah has come as the embodiment of the shadow. Now here he's talking about Moses' understanding of the reproach of Messiah. In other words, he's trying to tell us that Moses' actions were based upon his intelligent understanding of where he was heading, of whom he was a type. Remember what God told him in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy?
Not that, of course, he knew, he was told that before this incident. But I believe that Moses knew that in its embryo stage, that I will raise me up a prophet like unto you. And Moses saw that. Now you take Stephen's comment in Acts chapter 7 again. Stephen helps us immensely in our understanding of Hebrews 11 as far as Moses is concerned. And you see, Stephen puts it even more explicitly than what Paul does. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen makes this point about Moses in verse 25. He says, or verse 24, "And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them." That's what Paul's saying just by using the word Christ. Moses put first in his mind the reproach of Christ. In other words, he thought that everyone would understand that God would through him deliver his people. And that's what Messiah was coming for. So Moses clearly understood what he was doing. It was a choice based upon a clear perception of God's purpose in himself, which ultimately, of course, would then blossom out in his purpose with the Messiah. Paul, I believe, brothers and sisters, never uses that loosely. He doesn't put that in there to tell us, if he wanted to talk about Jesus, or that, he'd say that, but he doesn't. He said Christ. You take, for example, when that title is used in another place, very significantly, and in that sense of the Messiah, you know, therefore being a prophet of God, knowing that God with an oath to him had sworn that of the fruit of his loins he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne, he, seeing this before, spake of the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in hell, neither did his holy one see corruption, and so on. Now what Peter is saying in the second chapter of Acts is this: whoever the Messiah is, if you don't believe it's Jesus at this point, whoever it is, he's got to be a resurrected man. So he uses the title Christ. He, seeing this before, spake of the resurrection of Christ. Don't matter about whether it's Jesus, forget that at the moment, says Peter. Whoever it is, he's got to be a resurrected man. So you see, when they use that title of Christ, they do with a very pointed meaning. So Moses esteemed the insult of Christ greater riches than treasures in Egypt. In other words, brethren and sisters, if he was insulted for his belief in the coming Messiah and his own enacting of the parable of the redemption in the Messiah, if he was insulted for that, it was a treasure far above all the treasures in Egypt. Who esteemed the insult of Christ greater riches than the riches of this world? Didn't Peter and John come out of that prison and rejoice that they were accounted worthy to suffer for his name? That's what they did. That's what Moses did. If he was insulted in the court of Pharaoh, that, as far as he was concerned, was a bar of gold. To be insulted for the name of Messiah was a bar of gold far above the treasures in Egypt. It was an absolute wonder to be able to suffer for the hope of Israel and for the hope of Messiah. That's what Moses did, brethren and sisters. He had an incredible mind. And Paul says this, the reason why he had that sort of faith, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Now he's talking about riches. He's talking about riches. And he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Now here's the important sentence here. The Greek text, brothers and sisters, must be understood here. The Greek word for recompense means to look away. He looked away. Rotherham renders it just that way. He renders it, he looked away unto the reward. You imagine that. You picture him in that court, you know, being courted, actually, by the daughter of Pharaoh to encourage him as she adopted him into her own family and looked upon him as her own son, full of pride for that boy, being encouraged to take upon himself the title of her son and consequently stood as the heir of all the treasures in Egypt. And when he made a choice to be noted with the slaves down there in the land of Goshen, spat upon probably by some of his contemporaries and looked scornfully at and said, well, what a choice that is to make. And what did Moses do, brethren and sisters? He turned away from the glistening gold and silver and jewels of Egypt and he looked away to the recompense under reward. And he saw far off, brethren and sisters, a treasure far outweighing all that was in Egypt. He looked away. What a wonderful expression that is. How often in our life are we called upon to do that? Have you ever been called upon to look away? You know, you might be caught up and embroiled in a circumstance in life to make a big decision. You know in your heart of hearts where your decision should be. But you find excuses. You water down that principle. And you try desperately to overcome that principle somehow that we might have the best of both worlds. Until finally, brethren and sisters, Yahweh brings you to a point when you can do nothing else but look away, leave it behind us, and look over there. The recompense of the reward. And that's what he did. Imagine Moses in the court of Pharaoh, staring into space. You could almost see him. You know, he just wasn't in the place. He was far, far away from that place. And finally, Paul makes this point, he forsook Egypt, physically, because his mind was never there. He followed his mind. And finally, he got out of the place. You know, it's incredible, isn't it, how these men came through such temptation as they did. We talk about living in isolation. You know, I'd hate to live in isolation. Yet, perhaps you could be in isolation and have no temptations around you that we have in the world here. Could be in the country somewhere. But we'd probably weaken in isolation. He was in worse than isolation. He was in a situation where he was surrounded by the wealth of the world and he stood to be the heir of the lot. And he looked away from it all. Oh, an incredible man of faith was Moses. No doubt about that. And Paul goes on and tells us, brethren and sisters, that he forsook Egypt. Now, it's obvious that Paul doesn't mean that when he fled the first time from Egypt, that he forsook Egypt, because he didn't, in the sense that Paul says. Because he says he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. But see, the first time he forsook Egypt, it was for the very reason that he did fear the wrath of the king. Remember? Killed the Egyptian, and later on he separated two Hebrews. We all know the stories. And when they said, "Will you kill us as you did the Egyptian?" And he feared, it says, and he fled out of Egypt. And that's not the incident that Paul's talking about. It was the second time he left Egypt that Paul's talking about, because the word that Paul chooses, forsook, is a word which means to utterly forsake. He left Egypt. And you know, brethren and sisters, all he did, as I've said, was to walk out of the place bodily. His mind had long ago left Egypt. He was looking away, and his mind was miles and miles from Egypt, and his body followed that mind. He forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Not fearing the wrath of the king. Have you ever been through the life of Moses and followed the debate between him and Pharaoh? Some of you have done that? Got a mark down on the bottom of the page somewhere in Exodus for the great debate. And you try and imagine, brethren and sisters, the courage necessary to conduct that debate as points were given and lost by Pharaoh and concessions were asked for and denied by Moses as Moses stood uncompromising before that king and the king tried to compromise him again and again and Moses refused to give an inch. Not fearing the wrath of the king. You know, brethren and sisters, when kings make concessions, they consider that an act of grace. You knock back a concession from a man in Pharaoh's position, you could lose your head. And Moses did it repeatedly. I've got here just an epitome of what happened. Good thing to mark, and I was going the wrong way. Mark was in the margin of the Bible. It's not all the debate, it's just, what's happened? What's going on, Chief?
Where is he?
Further away. It's only on the one side.
That's not going to be better. Ah, there it is. No,
we ought to be right. Let my people go. Pharaoh says, "Go ye, sacrifice to God in the land." He's making confession. He's the king of Egypt. Moses said, "We will go 3 days into the wilderness." That's a little bit more than what Pharaoh said. He said, "You stay in the land." Moses said, "I want to go 3 days into the wilderness." Pharaoh comes back and says,
ye shall not go very far away. Moses replies that he is not letting my people go to sacrifice unto Yahweh. Beware. Now he's arguing with the king of the world, not fearing the wrath of the king. Pharaoh says, not so. Go ye now that are men and serve Yahweh. Moses replies, our young and with our old sons and daughters, our flocks and our herds, will we go? Lock, stock and barrel. Not having a bar of it, just sending the men. Pharaoh knew that if the men went, they wouldn't go too far away from their wives and children. All their goods, they'd come back. So did Moses know it. Pharaoh says, finally, go now. Let your flocks and herds be saved, yet let your little ones go with you. And the king probably thought, brothers and sisters, well, look, they've got their wives and their family. All I'm asking for is their cattle. Moses, you know, this is a great concession. Moses said, our cattle will go also with us. Now there, brothers and sisters, was an uncompromising attitude. And that was before the king of the world. Man that had power to kill him at just a flick of his finger. Not fearing the wrath of the king. I'll leave that there for a while because I see some of you want to take that down. But that is really beautiful, brethren and sisters. You want to? There's a little bit more to it than that. If you like to look it up in the text, you can fill that out. And in the bottom margin somewhere, you can put that down as the great debate and just show the way in which Moses defied that king and refused to accept any compromise or any concession that that king was offering. And when they finally went, they went lock, stock and barrel. There was no compromise there with Moses. So Paul's point that he's not fearing the wrath of the king is very pointed. For he endured as seeing him who is invisible. And I think I've spoken about this before, brethren and sisters, in Hebrews 11. You know, it won't hurt us to dwell upon that again. You try and visualize what Moses saw. Nobody, of course, can possibly conjure up a vision of God personally. We don't know, do we? It's even, I said, irreverent perhaps even to try. But there can be in our minds, brethren and sisters, some conception of the unspeakable glory that exists around the Father. We know that no man can look upon him and live. We know that Paul talks about the King, immortal, invisible. We all know that. And yet there's got to be some conception in our mind of that unspeakable glory in which the Father dwells. And one can appreciate, as Moses marched into that court, with no concession to be made, Pharaoh having thought over the matter as plague after plague struck him and he was making concession after concession. Moses rigidly sticking to his course and coming before that king and knowing, brethren and sisters, the king surrounded by his soldiers, spears at the ready, Moses standing there. The king says, now look, Moses, I've had enough of this. I'm a very gracious king and I've been very tolerant with you. Now I am prepared to do this, that and everything else. And Moses, no way. Lock, stock and barrel, no way will we compromise. And the king's face glowing with anger. And Moses looking straight at him, brothers and sisters, and behind him, seeing the invisible. And Moses saw the potentate of all the earth, Yahweh himself, standing over Pharaoh and crush his life as you'd crush the life of a moth. That was faith, brothers and sisters. That's real faith. Not fearing the wrath of the king, he endured as seeing him who is invisible. You take Psalm 16. How did the Lord ultimately triumph? We know what this psalm says. The psalm that Peter quoted in the second chapter of Acts speaks of the resurrected Lord. Well, how did he get that far? He says in the 8th verse of Psalm 16, I have set Yahweh always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Therefore, my heart is glad and my glory rejoiceth. My flesh also shall rest in hope. For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell. Neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. I have set Yahweh always before me. And when Peter quoted those words, he translated them this way. I have set the Lord always before my face. So that's what the Hebrew word before means, to before one's face. And the Lord, brothers and sisters, went into the grave, knowing this,
that he died right at the right hand of God. I have set the Lord always before my face. He is at my right hand. Now, they are the words of the Lord Jesus Christ. Peter said they are his words. He therefore died upon the cross with the Father standing right alongside of him. That's how he saw it.
And therefore, he says, my heart was glad and my flesh shall rest in hope. He didn't have a worry in the world. And that's the faith of Moses. That's a little bit greater than Moses' faith. But it's the same kind of faith, brothers and sisters. Men who saw God ever so close to them, standing alongside of them. I foresaw the Lord always before my face. He saw the invisible. And in that way, he died a happy man. My heart was glad, and his flesh would rest also in hope. And God didn't leave his Holy One to seek corruption. Now, the last thing that Paul says about Moses, and it's all we want to say tonight also, brothers and sisters, because we honour a new section then. The last thing that Paul says about Moses is quite striking. Something that we haven't perhaps thought about a lot, but in verse 28, notice this. There are two words that need covering in this verse. I'll emphasise them. Through faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Isn't that interesting? Through faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Then the apostle goes on and says, by faith, they passed through the Red Sea. But forget verse 29 for the moment. Look at verse 28. He kept the Passover, lest the destroyer should touch them. Now, you read Exodus 12, you think, well, all Israel kept the Passover. Yes, they did, brethren and sisters, but really, he did. You look at that record. Read it sometime. Notice the instructions that Moses gives. Notice how Yahweh gives him those instructions. Notice how Moses carefully lays down before the people, how he supervised the whole thing. You know, brethren and sisters, it's beautiful when you think about it, because Paul's not only saying here that it was the inspiration of Moses that kept that Passover, but there's a point to be made. There's a subtle point to be made. In Romans chapter 3, I believe this was the subtle point that Paul was making about Moses when he spoke about that man's individual faith in keeping the Passover. In Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, Paul makes the point that for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. Now, alongside the word remission, you've got a marginal alternative, passing over. You know, brethren and sisters, that's the only place in the Greek Testament where that word's found. There's no other occurrence of it. Read it again. Whom God has set forth to be a mercy seat through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the passing over of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. And you know, brethren and sisters, that was only done in one way. If the passing over of sins came about through the declaration of his righteousness, and all have fallen short of the glory of God, who was it declared it? Only one. His blood. Now, Israel are coming out of Egypt. They have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Their faith, brethren and sisters, would have never got them out of that land. Well, not saying either that Moses hadn't sinned. There's never been a perfect man except the Lord. But in type, brethren and sisters, what Paul was setting before us was the fact that had it not been for Moses' faith, had it not been for Moses' understanding of the principle, they'd have never got out of Egypt. He kept the Passover. And therefore, he was the one that declared very carefully to them the righteousness of God. And it was through faith in his blood, because that Passover blood, I think, can truly be said in that sense to be Moses' blood. And when they were baptized, says Paul, they were baptized into Moses.
so that there was clearly set before them the fact that this man's individual faith was quite marvellous. And also, brethren and sisters, there was a prophecy there that when the final deliverance would come by the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, with God passing over sins, then it would be because of one man's faith and not because of ours. Absolutely beautiful and very wonderful the way that the apostle sets forth that principle. And he makes the point too, that it was through the action of Moses that he that destroyed the firstborn didn't touch them. And you know, you take firstborn. If you came to a person, say you got married, and you had a little boy, brought that child in your arms to the ecclesia and said, "This is my firstborn," people would infer from your statement that you intended to have other children. That's what God intended. When he said to Pharaoh, "Let my son go, Israel is my firstborn, let my son go," he was telling Pharaoh that he didn't only want Israel out of Egypt because he wanted to save Israel, he wanted to save the world. Pharaoh, brethren and sisters, in a sense, was acting against his own eternal well-being by keeping those people there, because God wanted to develop a family of whom that nation was to be the firstborn. But they were unworthy of that. Now here's Moses, and the people are delivered by his faith. You know, brethren and sisters, there was a sense in which that man was the firstborn of God in that deliverance. He was the one born of God, born by the power of faith, and it was his action that got those people out of Egypt. He was the firstborn of that nation, as that nation could have been the firstborn of other nations. Beautiful, Paul's expression, "Lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them." And Israel's firstborn were delivered, and Moses stood preeminently as the type of the great firstborn, of whom it was said, wasn't it, brethren and sisters, that he, that is the Lord Jesus Christ, was the firstborn from the dead. And had it not been the fact that the Lord came out of an Egyptian darkness of the tomb, as a singular unit, one who manifested God's righteousness, nobody would come out. You know, it's rather beautiful, therefore, the use of the pronouns he and them, that Paul should spell that out quite clearly, that Moses' faith, brothers and sisters, was not simply the faith of an individual in God. It was a faith which had for its background Moses' clear understanding of the destiny of, that God had with him, that he could, would be a type of the Christ, a type of the one who, through whose, his faith, would cause the nation to keep that sacrifice through which they'd all be brought out of Egypt, baptized into Moses and in the sea, and then, of course, to go through the wilderness of life towards the promised land. And we probably could leave it there, Gordon, for any questions, if anybody wants to ask any questions or make any comment, perhaps.
You know, your point of, in verse 24 about, you know, when Moses has come to years, and you suggest that 40, isn't it? I think it's, doesn't Josephus say he was 12 at that time?
12?
Not that you're better than Josephus.
No, I believe Stephen. See, Stephen's point 40, is the same, 40, isn't it?
Yeah, he says 40.
Yes, well, of course, Stephen's dealing with the incident when he was rescuing the Hebrew brethren, didn't he? But I believe that the choice, Gordon, of the incidents is the same. I believe it was the same time. See, Paul's point, when he was come to years. I think it's Exodus, isn't it? Let's have a look at Exodus.
Well, Stephen does say about going down to going back to Israel, doesn't he? And
in the 7th chapter of Acts, first of all, what's Stephen's
when
point?
He was full 40 years old, and he came into the hut to visit his brethren and the children of Israel. And in verse 25 of Hebrews, said, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God.
It was around about the same incident.
Same time.
See, in Exodus, for example, it just says this, doesn't it? I think it's Exodus 2, isn't it? Where's my notes here? Exodus 2 verse 11, that's right, we quoted that earlier. It merely says here, and it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown. Now that's obviously the text, isn't it?
That he was 40.
Yes. Now Stephen makes that 40, and I believe that Paul says he chose rather to suffer affliction. Now it was that incident whereby he slew the Egyptian and delivered the Hebrew, which was the decisive act, wasn't it?
Right.
He couldn't have made it any more plainer. I kill that man and I save that man. So there was his choice, wasn't it?
Yes.
And the word that John uses, it comes from the Egyptian tablets.
Mm.
Significant. This is the time of the
Passover. Yes, this is right. Yeah. Yes, that is significant.
In that 11th verse, how old do you think Moses was then?
I think he was 40 years old.
Well, how long, then later on, when the few verses are on, he went and fled?
Yes, that's right.
How long did he think, how old would it be before he came back?
80.
Well, in the Hebrew then, how old was he in the
24th verse? 40. See, the thing is this, he grew up from a child, and when he got to the age of 40, you have recorded the incident when he separated the two Hebrew brethren, and he killed the Egyptian fellow, wasn't he? Now, he was 40 then. Then he fled into the land of Midian, where he was for 40 years in the desert. Right? 80. And then he brought Israel out of Egypt, and he died just this side of the border of the Promised Land at the age of 120. So his life is made up of 3 40s. Three cycle of 40 years each. His life is made up that way. But both Paul and Stephen see the age of 40 as being, in their view, an age of particular maturity. But at that time that men ought to have grown up sufficiently to make a decision. I would have thought it would have been about 20 years.
John, in regard to the different demands that Moses made on Pharaoh, they progressed, from wanting to go a day again into the wilderness and then finally to take the whole nation right out.
No, I don't think they really progressed, Mona. If you look here, I know what you're saying, you can read that from it, but see, the point that Pharaoh was making was to go sacrifice to God. Now, Moses wasn't saying that, first of all, they'd only go 3 days during the wilderness and come back again. The point being made was sacrifice. He says, in other words, we won't sacrifice until we are 3 days away from Egypt. Do you follow me?
In other words,
oh, it was a total demand. There's no suggestion that Moses sort of added to his point. He never had any other point but total rejection of Egypt. The point he's making about the sacrifice is that, look, really, Maynard, it was an insult to Pharaoh, because what he's saying is this. Pharaoh says, go sacrifice in the land. Moses' point was, listen, until I'm 3 days away from this place, I won't sacrifice to Yahweh. You know, yet it was an abomination for the Egyptians to eat with the Hebrews. So that I don't think that, some have thought that Moses sort of added to his demands, but I don't think he did. I think that it was always in Moses' mind that when they went, they went. And it was the point about sacrifice that, he was arguing with Pharaoh about.
John, how many
verse 3 of the question is that during the first part of the evening we spoke about Moses being hid, and it seems to be contradictory of Exodus chapter 2 verse 3. Yes. That's right. But now, Alan, we are assuming by the phrase, when she could no longer hide him, we are reading into that she was afraid the child would be found. Isn't it? That's what you're saying? That's how you could read that? But see, Paul's point is this. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, as if there was a time factor involved before they exposed him on the river. You follow me? So that when it says, when they could no longer hide him, it may not mean as we would seem to read, first of all, that they were frightened that the child would be found, but that the time factor had now come for him to be sent. You follow me? It was no longer, they didn't have to hide him any longer. The time had now come. And so she sent forth that child. And there he was. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. So there were carefully laid plans about that whole incident. It's like I said, Alan, if we never had Paul's comment in Hebrews, I would never have read into it what Paul did. I would have read it like you just suggested. The mere fact that they hid the child because they wanted to keep him alive merely, and when they thought he'd get caught and found, and they decided to put him in the river and so on. That's how I would have read it. I would never have read it the way that Paul put it. But the fact we've got Paul's comment, we've got Stephen's comment, is the thing which has given us a new slant on that record. Because it was not, in their opinion, it was not the action of parents just trying to preserve the life of a child. It was the action of faith. Now, you know yourself, if you were just trying to preserve the life of that child, it would not necessarily be faith, would it? There'd be hundreds of parents in there would want to just save their children, but not necessarily by faith. So you see, this was a different action. And as I said, if we hadn't had the comment of Paul or Stephen, we certainly would never, I would have never read that into it.
Just before you go on, Arthur, the words of Stephen in casting out, John explained beautifully, I thought, but the idea, I think, you know, you can imagine the bulrushes and the still waters of the Nile, say, staying still around the bulrushes, and then a little nudge of that little wicker basket out into the stream, and off it goes. It seems deliberate.
Well, you see, not only that, but you see, it was in the Nile, Gordon, that they were drowning them. So they were putting him right in the on the executioner's block, as the saying is. Really?
Your point? Sorry, Arthur.
In reference to the alleged request of her, the first request was, let my people go, let my firstborn go, or I shall wipe them. That is the very first request.
Oh, yes, this is right. Oh, there was never any doubt as to what Moses wanted.
So that request would be after that faith to tell her to get out of it. You know, you tell us that whole thing, but it's just the firstborn, you tell her right from the beginning.
That's right, yes. Oh, yes, there was never any question at all as to what Moses wanted or what Yahweh's will was. It was a total rejection of Egypt, a total leaving of the place. No doubt about that.
No further questions, brothers and sisters? All right, we'll conclude there.
I appreciate this. Brother Roberts, in his book on the ways of providence, mentions this fact, Gordon, that In the great act of faith on the part of Jochebed, Moses' mother, she finally finished getting paid to do what was the sole ambition of her life to do, and it's look after her own child.
Yeah.